Introduction to Tell at a Glance. In February 1976, at the request of the magazine 17, I agreed to write a science fiction mystery which would have a bicentennial angle. In response to that request, I wrote To Tell at a Glance, making use of the same social background I had used in Good Taste, which appears in this collection, just a month earlier. I thought the results were highly satisfactory, but I, alas, am not the editor. I don't make the decisions in such cases. 17 was not satisfied and regretfully handed the story back to me. I was left in a quandary. I had written what I imagined to be a story that would appeal to young women, and I was reluctant to chance the standard science fiction magazines with it. Finally, I cut it in half and sent it to the Saturday Evening Post, which took it and ran it in their February 1977 issue. The cutting, however, induced a deep melancholy in me, for despite 17's decision, I had a great fondness for the original story, and this is my opportunity to present it as it was to begin with. Story 20. To Tell at a Glance. 1. Elaine Metro waited with considerable composure. She had been a tourist's guide for 2 years now, almost, and having to handle men, women, and children from a dozen different worlds, to say nothing of Earth itself, keeping them happy and safe, answering their questions and meeting instant emergencies with instant action, gives one composure. Either composure or breakdowns, that is, and Elaine had never broken down. She never expected to. So she sat there and practiced, as she often did, being aware of her surroundings. The calendar gleamed the date at her, February 25th, 2076, which meant that she was 6 days past her 24th birthday. The mirror beside it reflected her face, or would if she just stretched a little to one side, and gave it a faint golden glow. That masked the natural paleness of her skin, and gave her blue eyes the illusion of light hazel, and her brown hair the illusion of a touch of blonde. Rather flattering on the whole, she thought. The news strip flashed on and off occasionally. There seemed nothing vital going on in the orbit. A 14th colony was under construction, but that was nothing extraordinary. There was a drought in Africa, back on Earth, but that was nothing extraordinary either. Imagine a world that had no way of controlling its weather. Primitive. But Earth was huge, like a million real worlds smashed together. And yet, it had so little room. Even Gamma, where Elaine had been born and where she lived, even Gamma was a little too crowded. 15,000 people and... The door opened, and Janos Teslin came out. He was the assembly chairman and a good one, Elaine thought. At least, she had voted for him. He said, "Hello, Elaine. Have I kept you waiting long?" "According to the clock, 14 minutes, sir." Janos laughed briefly. He was a large man with eyes that smiled sometimes, even when his lips didn't. His graying hair was crew-cut, quite out of fashion, and it made him look older than the 50 he probably was. "Come in, Elaine," he said. "Sit down." She sat down, accepting the use of the first name quite naturally, even though she had never spoken to the chairman before. On a world like Gamma, where nearly everyone knows nearly everyone, why not? Janos sat back on the swivel chair in his large room, larger than any private room Elaine had ever seen before, and said, "It's interesting that you should tell me you've been waiting 14 minutes. Shouldn't you have simply said you waited only a little while?" Elaine said, "I think precision in small things can be important." "Very good. I'm glad you feel so, for it is what I need of you. Your grandparents came from the United States region of Earth, didn't they?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you've retained your American heritage, I suppose?"
"I've studied Earth history at college. American history was included, but I'm a Gamma person."
"Yes, of course. So are we all. But you're a particularly special Gamma person, since you're going to save us all."
Elaine frowned slightly.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Never mind that now. I've gotten ahead of myself.
Since you are of American descent, I am sure you know that the United States was founded in 1776,
Yes, this year is their tricentennial. And that the United States was founded out of 13 individual states. Also, that there are now 13 separate and functioning worlds in the lunar orbit. 8 of them here in the L5 position, trailing the moon, and 5 in the L4 position, preceding the moon. Yes, sir. And a 14th is under construction in L4. Never mind that. The orbital world Nu was hastened, and the one now under construction, Xi, is being slowed, so that all through 2076 there will be 13 orbital worlds, and not 14 or 12. Do you see why? Elaine said dryly, "Superstition?" Yano said, "Your sharpness cuts, young woman, but I do not bleed. The matter is not superstition. It's a matter of taking advantage of sentiment. The United States is the most important single region of the Earth Federation, and if they are ready to vote for the establishment of an independent federation of orbital worlds, this will be the year to do it. Combine the tricentennial with the number 13, and they couldn't resist, could they?" I can see there would be the impulse. And independence for us would be useful. The Earth Federation is a conservative force that limits our expansion. Once we are no longer tied to Earth, the orbital worlds could adjust to fit each other's economy more efficiently. We could outgrow these narrow limits in the moon's orbit and head out for the asteroid belt, where we would become a major force in human history. Do you agree? Those who know seem to think so. Unfortunately, there are strong forces on Earth against independence. Then, too, even though almost every orbital worlder is for independence, not all of them are for union. What do you think of the other worlders, Elaine? You meet them constantly in your work. Elaine said, "People are people, sir, but other worlders have different ways, and I find them unsympathetic at times." "Exactly. And they find us unsympathetic. And rather than have union, many of the people of the world would refuse independence. Elaine, it's up to you to give us union." Back to that, thought Elaine. She said, "What have I to do with it?" "Listen," said Janos gently, "and I'll explain. Those on Earth who are opposed to independence count on the hostility between the orbital worlds and do their best to increase it. What if some sabotage takes place here on Gamma, which is the strongest force for union in the orbit? What if it is serious sabotage, and it seems that some particular other world is responsible? Anti-union sentiment would rise in Gamma, and there would then be little likelihood of independence this year. Afterward, with the magic of 76 no longer pulling for us, it might not come for many years." "We must guard against sabotage, then." "Right, and so we do. That's where you come in. There are 5 people coming to Gamma, ordinary tourists, apparently. There are many more than those 5, of course, but it is those particular 5, one from each of 5 different orbital worlds, who interest us. One of our agents on Earth, we have them, you know. Everyone knows, especially Earth, I think." Janos put his head back as though to focus on her more efficiently. He said, "You have a way of saying these things that I like. One of our agents got a message to us, badly garbled, unfortunately. An Earthman is coming to Gamma, a skilled saboteur, and he's coming as an orbital worlder. The message should have told us the particular disguise he would be assuming, but that was the garbled part." "I suppose you can't check with your agent because he is now dead."
"Unfortunately, he is.
We did what we could to interpret the message, and what we extracted could apply equally well to 5 people, at least 4 of whom are surely respectable otherworlders, and 1 of whom may be an Earthman in disguise." "Refuse entry to all 5, sir. Or let them in, arrest them all, and examine them thoroughly."
"But if we do that, we offend the other worlds in question,
and run the risk of doing just what the sabotage would do. Once you locate the saboteur, your actions would have been satisfactorily explained. If they believe us, then too, the message was sufficiently unclear to leave it a distinct possibility that none of the five is a saboteur, that all are legitimate. Well then, what is it you would have me do, Janos? Janos settled back in his chair, and for a moment his shrewd eyes once again weighed her quality. He said, "You're a tourist guide, and you're used to dealing with otherworlders and with Earth people. What's more, your record shows you to be rather formidably intelligent. I'll see to it that those five are assigned to you for an official tour of Gamma. They can't refuse such a tour without being impolite, so impolite as to give us an excuse to hold them. You'll be with them for several hours, Elaine, and all you have to do is tell us which one is the imposter, or perhaps that none of them is." Elaine shook her head. "I don't see how that can be done. Whichever it is must have practiced for the task." "Undoubtedly. I would suppose he had visited the other world of which he is pretending to be a citizen, speaks, looks, and acts like one, has the proper papers, and so on." "Well, then?" "But nothing can be done perfectly, Elaine. Find the imperfection. You have been on the various worlds in question. You know the other worlders." "I don't think I can..." "If you fail," said Janos forcefully, "we may have to fall back on cruder methods and risk offending the other worlds. Or we may hang back if you tell us there is no imposter, or take useless action if you spot the wrong one. And then who knows how much damage the sabotage may do to Gamma, quite apart from the failure of Union. You must not fail." Elaine's lips pressed tightly together. She said, "When does this start?" "They're coming tomorrow. They'll be landing at Pier 2 on the other side of the world." His thumb jerked upward in the almost inevitable gesture, and Elaine's eyes moved briefly upward in just as automatic a response. It was natural enough. Gamma, like all the orbital worlds, was a donut-shaped structure, a torus. In Gamma's case, the hollow torus within which the population lived was somewhat over 2 miles across. One could travel about 3.5 miles along the hollow curve of the torus to reach the other side of the world, or cut upward through one of the 3 spokes that linked opposite sides of the torus. Elaine remembered an Earthman laughing once at the orbital habit of talking about the other side of the world in reference to the other half of the torus. But why not? Gamma was surrounded by space, just as Earth was. Janos interrupted her train of thought. "You'll have to do it, Elaine." She said, "I'll try to do it, sir." "And you mustn't fail." 2. Elaine's two-room apartment was in Sector 3, and had the great advantage of being near the Center of Performing Arts. She had had a youthful dream of being an actress, but had lacked the voice for it. Yet she still enjoyed being bathed in the atmosphere of the theater. At the moment, as she prepared for the rise to Pier 2, she wished earnestly that her voice had been better and her talents more marked, so that she would not now be a tourist's guide with an impossible task facing her. She was dressed neatly. Her uniform fit snugly, and she looked efficient, as she always did. She made an effort to look empty as well. It occurred to her that if she appeared to the 5 tourists to be too curious, too knowing, she would surely learn nothing. In fact, if she seemed too probing, she might also seem too dangerous to a desperate man. Someone prepared to sabotage a world would not hesitate to deal sternly with 1 young woman. She looked up as she stepped outside. There was room within the torus to allow the raising of a 40-story building at the center, but 20 stories was the maximum allowed, and 10 stories was the average. The upper half of the torus was needed for the feeling of space and open air, to say nothing of allowing the entry of sunlight. The louvers overhead were still opening at a rate appropriate to the early morning. The large mirror that floated in orbit with Gamma reflected sunlight inward, and this bounced off smaller mirrors into the torus, The light bathed the structures on the ground side of the Great Donut and kept the temperatures within perfectly comfortable. Elaine had never been on Earth, but she had read of it often enough, and sometimes the even weather of Gamma made her long for just a little taste of Earth's disordered environment. Snow, especially. It was the one thing she couldn't properly imagine. Rain was something like a shower bath, fog something like steam, cold and hot like turning the proper taps in the steam rooms. But what was snow like? She wondered about that as she walked to Elevator Bank 3 and joined the line. There was not much of a wait, since she had managed to avoid the rush hour of shift change. The elevator carried her up the spoke through a mile of slowly decreasing gravitation. It was the rapid rotation of the torus, one turn every 2 minutes, that produced that centrifugal effect that kept everyone and everything pressed against the outer side of the torus, all around the donut, with a force matching Earth gravity. To everyone, wherever he was on Gamma, the outer rim of the torus was down, and the central hub was up. And, of course, the other side of the world past the hub was also up. As Elaine went up the elevator, the speed with which it turned around the hub of the torus decreased, of course, and so did the centrifugal effect. She was down to less than half her normal weight by the time she passed the hospital area, where lowered gravity was useful in treating cardiac patients, respiratory cases, and so on. Elaine enjoyed the sensation. She had once, during college, earned tuition money by serving as a nurse's aide, and she knew the low-gravity sensation well. Eventually, the elevator passed through the large spherical hub at the center of the torus, its movement carefully controlled by the central computer, so that no elevator collided with any other, as all converged at the hub in careful alternation. At the hub, the centrifugal effect was just about zero, and for the few minutes it took to pass through, she felt weightless. This was where Gamma's power station was located, and, Elaine thought somberly, where the sabotage might take place. The elevator passed through the hub and then moved along the spoke that connected with the other side of the world. The centrifugal effect was increasing again, and Elaine began to get the sensation of standing on her head. With the lack of effort, born of long practice, she quietly inverted herself, as one by one did the other passengers on the elevator. All were now standing on what had been the elevator ceiling some minutes before. The sensation was that of moving down now, and of increasing gravitational pull. And then, when the pull had reached maximum, and she was feeling, just a little regretfully, as heavy as she usually did, she was on the other side. The door opened, and she stepped out. The other side of the world, she looked up briefly, was now the place where she lived. 3. Avoiding the rush hour, Elaine was late, which turned out to be troublesome. The other three guides, two men and a woman, were already there and clustered about the daily worksheet. The woman, Mickey Bordeaux, saw her first and said, rather waspishly, "There she is." Elaine's eyebrows lifted. "Naturally. I work here." Mickey said, "It doesn't seem as though you do." She walked over on the cork-bottom shoes that added 2 inches to her diminutive height. She pushed her regulation cap off her forehead. That might be described as a nervous habit, but it did reveal her rich mahogany hair. She went on, "You've got 5 people there. Exactly 5. How's that for hard work?" Elaine reached for the worksheet copies. 5? That's all? 5. I've got 14. Hans has 10, and Robert has 12. Fair division? I think not. "It could be," said Elaine, "that they don't trust my work and are getting ready to relieve me of my duties." "Phasing you out?" said Robert. A dimple appeared on either cheek when he smiled, so he smiled often. "Exactly what I said. Then you'll be stony broke, with no chance of any other position, and you'll have to marry me, right?" Elaine said, "I've got you in mind, Robert, constantly. Just as soon as I'm stony broke. Have you taken this up with Benio Strammer? He's the one in charge of the worksheets." "Yes, I did," said Mickey. "And he just said that's the way it was, old..." The last word was lost in a mutter. Elaine said, "All right. Look, Robert, your 12 are mostly from Alpha, which means they'll be interested in our sports facilities. And that's your baby, right? Hans has a lot from Mu. And they're all first generation, and probably nervous about anything new. and we all know how fatherly he is.
"Paternal is my middle name," said Hans, crossing his arms over his rather narrow chest.
"And, Mickey, you've got them from Zeta, and most of the Zetans hate our guts, so they're going to need someone who looks little and helpless and very pretty. No one can hate you."
"The women can," said Mickey, softening.
"Yes, but the tourists you have are mostly men, right? As for myself, I've got five, but they're from five different worlds. Each one is different. Each one will want to concentrate on something else, and I suspect each one is a VIP, and will want special treatment and be impossible to please." She sat back and allowed a look of melancholy to pass over her face.
"If anyone wants to change..."
"Not me," said Hans.
"My little Muans need me."
"And my Alphans," said Robert, "must have someone who knows a football from a golf club."
Mickey said, "I never said I wanted to change. I just wish they could even it up more."
Elaine nodded and went to her own small office, no larger than sufficed to hold a small desk, and this time, Benyo Strammer. He was waiting for her. His hair was richly white and wavy, and he looked at her quizzically, out of eyes nested in crow's feet. He said,
"You handled that very well, Elaine."
She said, "I take it you listened, Benyo."
"I had to. I was a little upset. That list came down to me that way. I didn't prepare it."
"Then we have to take it as given. Nothing else to do."
Benyo said, "But why, Elaine?"
"Why what?"
"Why did they make up the list for me?"
"Didn't they tell you, Benyo?"
Benyo shook his head and said, "No, they didn't."
"I guess they didn't want you to know, then."
"All right, but do you know?"
"If you're not supposed to know, you shouldn't even ask. Look, whatever it is, it's going to be touchy. Is the ship on time?"
"It's docking now." "All right, then. Could you arrange to have my five tourists separated out as quietly as possible and brought in before the rest? I think I had better see them before we get started. Try to get an estimate as to how I am supposed to handle this. You know, what I said to the others was probably right. I think they're VIPs, and I don't want to goof it up."
Benyo looked sour.
"I think it would be a lot better, Elaine, if they would cut me in on whatever's going on. If they keep me in the dark, then it's not my fault if I slip up."
"If it were up to me, Benyo, you could have it. Believe me when I tell you I don't want to touch this at all, whatever it is. Do you want it?"
"It came down for you specifically, didn't it? It's your thing. And if you want to see these people, you'd better use my office. This one isn't large enough. As for me, once they come in, I'll take a walk around the world." A world walk was something he did every once in a while. It kept him in shape, he said. Elaine looked down briefly at her own flat abdomen and wondered if she could rely on that as a fact of nature for much longer. 4. Elaine sat on the corner of Benyo's desk, the corner nearest the door, with her arms crossed over her chest and one leg swinging. She had firmly refused to consider the problem the night before, feeling, quite rightly, she was sure, that if she did, that she would spend most of the night wakeful and tense and be dim-witted today. Now, however, there was no excuse to put it off further. Problem. 5 people, each from a different world. One of them might be, just might be, an Earthman pretending to be an orbital worlder. Assuming the Earthman knew his job, would there be any way he could give himself away? Was there something about the orbital world to which, even with practice, he could not adapt? The trouble was, Elaine thought impatiently, that the orbital worlds had deliberately mimicked Earth's conditions. Each revolved at such a speed as to produce Earth-normal gravities in the torus. Any Earthman would feel completely at home in this respect. To be sure, gravity would drop off as one mounted the spokes, and an Earthman might not be able to avoid clumsiness there. The trouble was that not very many orbital worlders spent much time in the spokes, and most of them would be equally clumsy. The typical orbital world atmosphere had the same pressure of oxygen that the Earth atmosphere had, but much less nitrogen, so that the other world atmosphere was only half as dense as that of the Earth. That made little difference, though. Earthmen adapted to it almost at once. And why not? Earth had worse atmospheres than that, less pressure and less oxygen on its mountains.
Orbital worlds were much smaller than Earth. But what difference would that make? The vistas weren't as long in all directions as on Earth, and the horizon effect was quite different. But surely an Earthman could get used to that, too. The imposter, if there was one, would surely have lived on an orbital world long enough to have become used to this effect. To be sure, he might not know his way about Gamma, unless he had spent some time on Gamma. But then, people from the other world would not necessarily know their way about Gamma, either. Or, if the imposter had spent time on Gamma, might he know too much about it? No. There was nothing to say that any other worlder might not have read about Gamma before coming here for a visit. It might even be thought of as a natural thing to do. Well then, what about the worlds they were supposed to come from? People from a particular orbital world spoke in a particular way, had certain social and individual attitudes. Could the Earthman mimic these perfectly, or could he be expected to give himself away no matter how much he had practiced? Elaine looked down at the desk and turned the worksheet so she could see the items. 5 worlds. In order of age, they were Delta, Epsilon, Theta, Iota, and Kappa. She had visited each one of them, and had read copiously about each one of them in the line of duty. You can't understand tourists without understanding the societies that had molded them, and a guide had to understand tourists. Delta was a rather dull world of work-bound people, who spoke their language in a sing-song way, and did the same when they spoke the Gammon dialect. They tended to be large and fair in complexion, but that was only a tendency. There were tall people on each of the worlds, and short and fair and dark. You couldn't judge by physical appearance. Epsilon was the most crowded of the worlds, with a smaller-sized people by and large, and a stronger infusion of descendants of Earth's East Asians than was true for most of the worlds. Theta had 5 of the 6 sections devoted to agriculture, instead of the usual 3. It was the only one of the orbital worlds to go in heavily for cattle, as opposed to smaller livestock. As it happened, of the 5 symphonies composed by orbital world musicians that were now part of the general repertoire of earthly orchestras, 3 had been by Thetans. Elaine stopped to think about that a moment. No, one couldn't make the easy generalization that Thetans were musical. 95 of them could be musically illiterate, and if the Thetan who was in the group should turn out to be so, that would prove nothing. Iota was the great energy exporter of the orbital worlds. Each of the worlds had solar energy as its prime source. Each had a large power station, considerably larger than the colony itself, absorbing sunlight and converting it to microwaves, some of which went to the world's own global hub, and some of which, if surplus there was, went to Earth. Iota's was the largest power station, and it had the best facilities for beaming microwaves to Earth. It was quite understandable that Earth was presently more concerned with Iota than with any of the other 12 orbital worlds. But that meant that Iota was the most pro-Earth of the worlds, the least independence and union-minded. Would an Iotan not be the most likely to cooperate with an Earth agent? On the other hand, might an Earth agent not be least likely to assume an Iotan disguise, since that would be most suspect? How could she tell, she thought impatiently. And what about Kappa, leisure-centered, culture-riddled? It was the most attractive of the worlds she herself had visited. It meant she would have to keep her sharpest eye on the Kappan, since her own prejudices were involved there. How could one tell a Kappan from a pseudo-Kappan, or a Thetan from a pseudo-Thetan, or any variety from a fake variety? The trouble was that Earth was so various in its population types that any of the orbital worlders would be easily imitated by some particular Earthman or other. But consider this. The agent, whoever he was, would have to be against independence, and against the union of the orbital worlds. Would he have to avoid showing this and be ostentatiously anti-Earth? Or would he realize that that sort of ostentation would in itself be suspicious? Or, considering that the agent did not know anyone was looking for him, or did he, the question might not arise in either direction. Would it be safer to try for something more subtle? If the independence and union forces were relying on the emotional values of the tricentennial, could the conversation be maneuvered in that direction? Would the agent show impatience at the mention of 2076? Would he show anti-American sentiment? But then might not some orbital worlders have such feelings of their own accord, without there being any need to have them Earthmen in disguise? Elaine felt her mind moving in smaller and smaller circles, uselessly. What could she use as a criterion to tell the true from the false? Did any criteria exist? Yet Janos had said, "You mustn't fail." She was about to surrender to the luxury of despair, when Benyo put his head inside the door and said, "Your tourists are here. Hope it goes well, and goodbye." Elaine wondered if the goodbye might not turn out to have a particularly dreadful connotation. She composed her face as the tourists came to the door, and tried to compose her thoughts. 5. They were lined up before her, and Elaine spoke slowly, and she hoped, ingratiatingly. "My name," she said, "is Elaine. If you would be more comfortable with my family name, it is Metro." No titles are in use on Gamma, and the use of first names is common, but you may use any naming system you find convenient. The Delton seemed already disapproving. He was a tall man, and broad-shouldered. He was made taller by a blockish hat he did not remove, and by a long slate-gray blouse that he wore down to mid-thigh. His heavy boots clumped when he walked, and his bony, large-knuckled hands were lightly clenched. He said harshly in a sing-song tone, "How old are you?" His name, Elaine knew from the chart, was Sando Sanson, and from her knowledge of Delton ways, she knew she would have to address him by his last name. "I am 24 years old, Mr. Sanson."
"Do you know enough about this world at your age to be of use to us?"
His bluntness was Delton. Or was it overdone, Delton? Surely she had done nothing to warrant the bite. She smiled and said brightly, "I hope I know enough. I am quite experienced at my work. In fact, my government is reposing considerable confidence in me, since they expect me to see to it that each of you sees all he can of whatever aspect of life on Gamma you wish to explore." Ravon G. Andor of Kappa caught her eye. He was of medium height, and his hair was very carefully shaped. It was blonder than it should have been by nature. Elaine was sure of this, for it did not go with his dark eyes and complexion. And he was dressed with excessive ornamentation. He exuded a slightly pungent perfume that Elaine found attractive. All that was Cap'n. But was it too Cap'n? He said with broad, somewhat sustained vowels, "If you generously wish to meet our desires, then you yourself, I think, would represent a Gammon life aspect worthy of further study." It was meant to be complimentary, in the ornate Cap'n fashion, Elaine was sure. She used his first two names, as Cap'n custom required, and answered, quite Cap'n fashion, "I am desolated, Ravon G., that this is at the moment impossible. Perhaps time will offer an opportunity."
"Get on with it, girl,"
grunted Medjim Nabellan of Theta. Her richly black complexion, most Thetans, not all, were blacks, was topped by crisp gray curls, for the most part hidden under a broad-brimmed hat held to her chin by an elastic. Her clothes were gaily colored in broad stripes, and she rolled her R's back in her throat.
"Get on with it and don't waste your time humoring Cap'n trash."
The Cap'n bowed sardonically and did not lose his smile. Elaine paused a moment. There was no reason the agent might not be a woman, or a black, or both. And impatience at getting started might well be the primary and unconcealable emotion of anyone whose mission was to sabotage a world, and who saw danger in any delay.
"I think it's silly to have a group with everyone from a different world,"
said Eve Abderrahman of Iota, the other woman of the group, in a drawl so pronounced as to make her sound sleepy. She was rather young, rather small, rather attractive, in a light brown way. And she might have been well aware of this, for her costume was all in blending shades of brown.
"If we're going to quarrel and snarl at each other, this is all going to be very unpleasant."
"I hope we don't quarrel and snarl, Eve," said Elaine. Iotan used first names, as Gammons did. "And as soon as you each let me know what you particularly want to see..."
"Let's get started,"
said the fifth member, Wu Kai Shi of Epsilon.
"And we can tell you on the way, or we will waste time."
He was plump and short, and his eyes had more than a little of the East Asian narrowing. He wore a skirt-like affair that reached nearly to the ground, and he talked with the trace of a lisp. And he was another impatient one, Elaine thought. Elaine said, "Since we are in one of the residential sections, then, we might as well walk through the streets to the university as a start. There we will find some interesting examples of gammon architectural design." She herded them politely out ahead of her, circling them to take the lead, while her mind moved uselessly back and forth. Each one of them seemed worthy of suspicion, but not one of them seemed worthy enough. If there were only something that held true for all the orbital worlds and not for Earth, something so subtle and pervasive that an Earth imposter could not guard against it and would give himself away. But what could such a thing be? Size? Something else? She had to concentrate on her job. "This is the central building of Gamma University, built 4 years ago, with an illusion of curve just great enough to..." She talked on mechanically, but her mind, working in another direction, seized on the thought of the illusion of curve and went on from there. 6. They had walked leisurely past the pleasant homes of the section, each with their varying designs and their green lawns, all marked off ornamentally by light fencing material designed to produce differentiation rather than barrier. This section lacked the apartment house clusters that were to be found in the other two residential sections. Elaine said, "We are coming to the airlock that separates this from the agricultural sector ahead."
"You keep the airlocks open, I see," said Sanson. "Isn't that slipshod?"
His pronunciation of the last word was so odd by Gamma standards, Elaine barely caught it. Perfect Delton, as nearly as she could tell. She said, "Not really. It is thoroughly automated. Any vibration associated with meteoric strike or internal explosion, any small loss in air pressure, will cause all airlocks to close, sealing off the 6 sectors each from each. And of course they close during the night to keep the daylight of the agricultural sections from filtering into the residential areas."
"What happens," asked Ravon G., smiling,
"if the meteor or whatever strikes the airlock machinery?" "That is quite unlikely to happen. But if it does, it would not be fatal. All vital machinery exists in 2 complete sets, widely separated, each one of which is capable of supplying the needs of the whole world." She paused to make sure all her charges had managed the transition. It was just a matter of going up a flight of steps and down another, 6 up and 6 down. But the steps stretched the width of the torus and curved gently. Earthmen frequently found it amusing to walk the width of one step,
so they could find themselves slanting somewhat with respect to others in their party.
But though she watched the feet of all 5, none seemed to hesitate or turn to one side in momentary curiosity. Elaine sighed inaudibly. The Earthman, whichever he was well schooled. Or there was no Earthman. 7. Ravon G. Ander had been at her elbow all through the agricultural sector, showing no interest in any of it. Now, as they entered the cycling center, he drew back and looked unhappy.
"I don't have to get into that, do I? Animal waste aren't my idea of delightful scenery."
Elaine kept the alertness out of her eyes as much as she could. She said, "You recycle wastes on Kappa, surely?" No Earthman was ever willing to visit the center.
"Not in my presence," said Ravon G. "Actually, I know nothing about all this engineering and statistics. Come, dear girl, I'll wait out here. Let that Delton go, he has the boots for it. And that farm woman from Theta and the rest."
Elaine shook her head. "I appreciate your feelings, but I can't leave you. I'm afraid my government would disapprove. Do come. I'll hold your hand, see?" It was the kind of flirtatious gesture that no Kappan could refuse with honor. Ravon G., looking terribly unhappy, murmured,
"In that case, lovely one, I would wade through muck knee-high."
Elaine didn't think he would, though. She kept close to him as they passed through the antiseptic corridors. Most of the cycling process was hidden from view and was handled in completely automated fashion. Despite the manner in which Ravon G. screwed up his face, there was only a faintly perceptible odor. Sanson looked at everything keenly, his large hands clasped behind his back. Wu Kai Shi, expressionless, took notes, and Elaine managed to pass behind him and see what he was writing. It was in Epsilonian, and even the script was unreadable to her. Revanji, still holding her hand, said, I presume you will tell me that all this is essential. So it is, she said, even on a very large scale on Earth. He did not respond to the last comment. A Kappan gentleman, he said, remains unaware of such things. She said, what do you do on Kappa? I'm a drama critic. I'm here to review the Gammon stage for my home paper. Oh, will you be visiting Earth for the dramatic festival in connection with the tricentennial? She wondered if there were such a festival.
The what, my dear?
He looked blank. The American tricentennial. He said vaguely, I don't know. Where is your theater district located? Was his vagueness overdone? Did he really know nothing at all about the tricentennial? She said, it's on Section 4, the other side of the world. She started to make the inevitable gesture, but did not. He looked up, very briefly, as one always did, and said despondently, well, we'll get there eventually, I suppose. Interesting, thought Elaine. Would that be the key? 8. Medjim Nebelin said to her brusquely,
see here, guide. We are moving out of this farming district, and I have seen no cattle.
We have some, but not in this sector. We find cattle uneconomic. Chickens and rabbits can produce more protein more quickly.
Bunk! You don't know how to do it properly. Your animal husbandry methods are well behind the times.
Elaine said smoothly, I am sure our Bureau of Agriculture would be delighted to hear from you.
I hope so. That's precisely why I am here. And now that I have seen what you are doing here, any further touring is a waste of my time. I would like to go directly to the Bureau.
Elaine said, I'm afraid I will be in trouble if you insist on leaving the party. My government will feel I have offended you.
Nuts,
said Nebelin grimly, her wide nose wrinkling.
Where can I find the Bureau?
On the other side of the world, said Elaine. This time she gestured firmly, and Nebelin looked up. If you leave now, the party may break up altogether. Please stay. Medjim Nebelin said something under her breath, but she made no further move to break away. Elaine said in her pleasant guide's voice, the agricultural sectors are bathed in sunlight at all times, but in the three residential sections, of course, it is 16 hours light and 8 hours darkness in alteration. Wu Kai-shi said, do all gamins sleep in unison? No, of course not. They sleep when they please. In fact, some must work through the dark period.
Why not allow each dwelling place to control its own sunlight, then? Useless conformity.
He made further notations in his book. Eve Abderrahman said in her thin and very clear soprano voice,
since Epsilon is the only world without standard day-night reflection, it must be you who are out of step. A night interval reduces energy influx and keeps the temperature comfortable.
Not at all, said Wu Kai-shi, raising his eyebrows. If you imply Epsilon is hot, you are wrong. This day-night alteration is only a meaningless heritage from Earth.
Elaine tingled. A slur on Earth? She said brightly, I don't think we should ignore our earthly heritage. The tricentennial is here this year, and a heritage of free... She faded out, as neither reacted. Eve cast a look of impatience at her, and then turned to the Epsilonian.
I have been on Epsilon, she said, and found it hot.
You may have found it too flexible and individual for your taste, returned Wu Kai-shi stiffly.
Elaine said, please, won't you two follow me now? We have a long way to get to the other side of the world. She gestured, and automatically they responded. She went on, we must catch up with the others. Eve said, as all three hastened their steps,
the cycling center must have a computerized component. It would be a great help for me in my mission here if I could have access to that.
I'm sure that can be arranged, said Elaine. I believe our government is very open here. Her mission? Was that an incredible oversight? Or pure innocence? She was barely 5 feet tall, But would height prevent her from... Sando Sanson was looking impatiently about.
You, Miss Metro, how much longer?
We'll be through soon, Mr. Sanson. Is there anything you particularly want to see?
The power station. I am an electrical engineer, woman, and I am not interested in grain fields and fish pools.
I'm not sure, said Elaine soothingly, if the hub is open to tourists.
I'm not a tourist, said Sanson heavily. I am an official of my government.
Yes, of course. We are on our way up a spoke to visit a hospital area. Gamma is proud of its medical facilities, and we would very much like for you to see it. While there, I will inquire for permission to enter the hub. Sanson nodded, but didn't look much mollified. 9. There was a hospital area in each spoke, 6 altogether. This one was higher up the spoke than the others, since it dealt with low-gravity biological research. All 5 of the tourists seemed at ease at low gravity, which was now little more than quarter normal. Midjim Nabellan stumbled once, but that seemed mere circumstance. Sanson looked outraged at moving higher than he expected at one point, and came down with a clatter, but did not fall. But then even Elaine sometimes forgot and took a giant step. I think you'll all be interested, she said, in the low-gravity research we are doing here. That's one line of investigation that can't be carried on back on Earth at all. And while all the orbital worlds are active in this field, none has gone as far as Gamma. We are entering the laboratories now, and there will be research assistants to describe the research and answer your questions. Oh, Mr. Sanson?
Yes?
I just wanted to point out to you that we are only 400 meters from the hub. Now I will try to get you an entry permit. They were alone now, the others having vanished into the hospital area. At Government Center, which is, of course, at the other side of the world. She gestured, and her heart beat high at his response. That had to be it. But there was no way in which she could keep her new knowledge from flooding her eyes, and Sanson saw it, and probably realized the mistake he had made. It was as if he suddenly dropped his role.
One moment, girl,
he said, with no trace whatever of his Delton accent. He moved toward her in a rush. She evaded him, like a matador side-slipping a bull with minimum motion. She couldn't, somehow, unblock her throat to call for help. Would he dare kill her? How would he explain her body? Or must nothing stand in the way of his mission? Would he kill her and then rush on to do what had to be done? He turned and lunged, but his foot slipped on ground made far more slippery than usual by low gravity. Elaine turned on tiptoe and sidled past him in a low-gravity maneuver with which she was well acquainted. He missed by a greater margin this time. He stopped, turned, edged slowly between her and the door, threw off his hat, and, tearing open the static seam that held his blouse together, threw that off too. He was hard-muscled and strong, and his face was grim. He had a matter of minutes to get rid of her before someone came, and he looked as though he were ready. She could call out now, but for the moment she dared not waste the breath for it. She kept her eyes on him as she swayed this way and that, playing him carefully. He was being equally careful, no longer disregarding the low gravity. He moved forward in small steps, but she drifted away, watching, watching. She shifted direction and moved forward in a longer glide, then whirled behind him and pushed. He flailed forward, but caught himself and was between her and the door again. And then she tried to get to the door for 1 minute longer than was safe, for his hand snaked out and seized her arm. For a moment they stood in tense stillness, and then his lips stretched into a merciless smile, and he drew her toward him. She called out hoarsely and kicked at him, but he blocked that neatly with his hip. She wrenched desperately, but did not pull loose. And then a dark arm passed around the Earthman's throat, clamping down on his windpipe and yanking him erect. Elaine was loose.
Thank you, she whispered.
Medjim Nabellan's expression was darker than her skin.
Has this Delton animal been...
He's not a Delton, said Elaine, gasping heavily now that it was over. She looked at the faces crowding around and said, Please, call the police, and please don't let go, Nabellan.
No fear, said Nabellan, unless someone wants to take over for a moment. Shall I break his neck for you?
She looked quite capable of it, and the Earthman's eyes bulged out of his face. No, please, said Elaine. I think he's needed alive. 10. She was back in Janos's office, 2 days after the earlier session with him. He was utterly jovial now, as he said, It couldn't have been better, Elaine. He was the man, all right. Delta denies all knowledge of him, and whether that is true or not, they are forced to plump heavily for union now. We have played up Medjim Nabellan's part, and Theta will strengthen its own pro-union stand. The Earth government is embarrassed, and the American region's tricentennial stand is now in an excellent position. While there are always unpredictables and unforeseens, I really think we will have independence and union before the magic year of 2076 is over.
But how did you do it, Elaine? How did he give himself away?
Elaine said, I had to think of something an Earthman would forget on an orbital world, even though the world was designed as like Earth as possible. At one point, I began thinking of curves. Earth is a large world, and its people live on an outside surface that curves down very gently. On the orbital worlds, the people live on an inside surface that curves upward. On Earth, the other side of the world is downward, far downward. In speaking of it, I imagine Earthmen point downward, or make no gesture at all. They certainly don't point upward. On an orbital world, the other side of the world is upward, and other worlders always point upward and look upward when they speak of it. You do, I do, we all do. So I tried it. I would mention the other side of the world to each one and point downward as I did so. It didn't matter that I did. Four of them looked upward anyway, quite automatically. It was just a brief glance in each case, but I could tell by that glance that they were orbital worlders. When I tried it on Sanson, his eyes followed my finger. He looked down, and I knew he was an Earthman. He recovered at once, but it was too late. I could tell at a glance, you see. Janos nodded his head. I would not have been that resourceful myself, Elaine. This will be worthwhile for you. You will be suitably rewarded. Elaine said, Thank you. But independence and union are the best rewards for all of us, aren't they?